This is Specific Objects, Talks on Art in the Catskills, and I'm your host, Miriam Atkin. Today I have here with me in the studio Catskill-based poet Stacy Samazic, and I'll start by sharing their bio. Stacy Samazic is the author of 7 books of poetry, Emptied of All Ships, Hyperglossia, Heart Island, Journey of Ugly Sights and Other Journals, which won the Ottoline Prize from Fence Books and was nominated for a Lambda Literary Award, A Year from Today, The Pasolini Book, and Famous Hermits. Their book essay will be published in 2025. They are the recipient of a 2014 New York Foundation for the Arts Fellowship in Poetry, a 2019 Foundation for Contemporary Arts Grant in Poetry, and are a 2024 McDowell Fellow. From 2007 to 2018, they were the director of the Poetry Project at St. Mark's Church. They enjoy teaching and mentoring younger poets, and have done both in a wide variety of contexts, including recently the ESB Fellowship Program they founded at the project in 2013, and Queer Art Mentorship. They live in New York's Upper Hudson Valley on the sacred homelands of the Munsee and Mahicaniac people, who, due to forced removal, reside in northeast Wisconsin at the Stockbridge Munsee community. So we're going to begin with a reading from a series of poems that Stacy is working on currently. The series is called Essay, and each poem within it is titled Essay. A few of the poems appeared in a journal called Peripheries earlier this year, along with an author's note. And so, Stacy, I invite you to begin.
Thank you, Miriam. Essay 6. The sun has been out for the past 3 days, and it has been cool enough to eat lunch outside. The air has been clear. Last weekend, we had 4 friends over to the house. Kind of an impromptu birthday party with people who happened to be in the area from the city. One friend brought the ice cream sandwiches we used to eat together the summer I left the city. We were all spread out on our sectional couch around a coffee table of snacks when it started to pour with thunder and lightning. We heard a distant thump and all ran to different windows. The dead junipers were still standing and the rainwater was rushing down the street. When the rain lightened, everyone returned to their rentals. In the morning, it was evident that the thump had been the sound of a neighbor's tree falling. They already had a crew chainsawing it into pieces. I put my shoes on for work and ignored the books in the front room, calling out for me, a rescue effort they perform often. But the best I can do is to touch them, move them from one meaningful stack to another, and practice powers of osmosis. I also touched the plants. The geranium flowered this week after 2 years of tending. I am so sweetly encouraged to exit the world of curses, though I have the marks of that system upon me, a body that screams of heaven and hell, with my animal protectors and pierced heart, my ailments that keep me present and teach utter refusal of war metaphor. Yesterday I read that the Atlantic Ocean current could collapse as early as 2025, and water temperature off the coast of Florida has reached 101.1. At work, we made the decision that the fundraiser should not reference fire. My colleague's voice from across the divider said, "Sinead O'Connor died." I asked her to repeat what she just said, such was the shock. The internet instantly assimilated the news with suggested search questions such as, "How old was Sinead O'Connor when she died?" But I knew. I received a message that my favorite cow, Donna, was in labor. By the time I got to the loafing shed, her calf was on her knees, rising up for the first time. She went directly to Donna's teats, but the cow, who had till now been a heifer, kept raising her hoof to keep her away. Most calves don't know what to do so instantly. I left the unfolding drama to go home, blasting The Lion and the Cobra on the drive with my leg against the door. O'Connor said the only careers she ruined after tearing up a photo of the Pope on live TV were those of record company dudes. It meant I had to make my living playing live, and I am born for live performance. She relieves me of a feeling of vengeance no punishment could touch. Her connection to her own practice and the kind of confidence that rose from it. She only regretted that people treated her like shit for not bowing to the hierarchy that even people making a satire show, even a crowd at a Dylan concert, bowed to. I've seen poets punish other poets for confidence that hasn't been properly bestowed by some system not properly obeyed. If you don't act needy, you will be punished in a way that lives on in extra personal vibes. Days have passed and the cow's calf will be raised by a nurse mom. Donna, mother to Donut, will be raised by Nickel. An apprentice told me it's because Donna is stubborn and a loner. One of the farmers told me it's because she's docile and new to the herd, trying to find her place in the social order, and to ask her to also do the work of protecting her calf is too much. She is Bronve and Jersey, Brown Swiss, Cross, daughter of Dolly, highest milk producer in the herd. Her coat is entirely white. People call her our unicorn. She had been living on an off-farm pasture and was brought back to integrate into the herd and have her first calf. There was excitement that she was back. The first time I saw Donna, I thought her all-white coat was a trick of sunlight. Days passed and cooler, drier weather came, making a series of perfect days. My drive to work this morning was delayed, possibly due to an aggressive falcon attacking pedestrians on the bridge. The young man in the car behind me was rocking out to music as I texted with my partner, who said it's too depressing to Google Hudson Valley bridges. It could also be a wounded duck creating such a prolonged standstill. I took extra enjoyment doing 55 on the dipped road through the cornfield, taking the curves a bit too fast. I had been feeling my mean streak thicken and felt less free. Driving alone through a field burned it up, along with my true age, disease, and debt. My parents were just people assigned to keep this dog alive till the dog became human and able to work. The grandest conundrum of my life, from cleaning a suburban family's house to this day, the chaotic middle of an excess of caring thinned out like the tail of a shooting star. I went away. I went to my parents, wherein time stands still. I lurked in their basement, rummaging through familiar things, and thought about stealing one of my dad's hats. My partner told me I don't need to steal things from their house to feel close to them, so I put it back. But not before my dad saw me and asked, "Are you stealing my hat?" Then there was a party, and family arrived through the garage door, as they have since before I was born. Except I have to remember how all of my grandparents used to enter a party, and I do. The weather was what I would call not extreme in any direction, salubrious. And there was constant goldfinch action at the feeders. Everyone had gotten thinner except for me, making friends with my old world body. My mom says she likes my rosacea because it gives me a little bit of color. I guess it's like the blush she always wanted me to wear. On the plane home, I read Brecht and Rotifer. When I hear myself sing, I say, "Today I'm happy. That's good for my skin." And the only happiness is to be shut up in art. The one time I met Stephen Rotifer, I showed him my tattoo of Cocteau's drawing of his sailor lover, Jean de Boer, that I came to through one of his books. He inscribed that book for Stacy at the Cocteau Upper Arm Church, XOX, before giving a reading wearing khakis that still had a plastic security tag on the cuff. I saw my partner across the aisle of the plane reading a book on Fassbinder. I was next to a woman who high-fived me back at the gate when we heard the storms in New York let up enough for us to take off.
So, something that I feel very viscerally when I hear that poem is the kind of time-space warp that happens when the narrative jumps from the traffic jam to the family home scene. The syntax kind of breaks, and then there's this short declarative sentence that says, "I went away." And it kind of jump cuts the poem to this other place. So I'm just wondering, what's the significance of that disjunct for you?
I think that the way I have a tendency, a compositional tendency in my work to be very associative, mm-hmm. and really just to trust that and not overthink it. So it's really kind of like having a light touch, I guess. And somehow believing that it works.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely a moment. I don't think I came across any short, clipped sentences like that otherwise. And it felt very, yeah, almost like you were on a rocket ship into some other place. Mm-hmm. And it sort of hyper-focused me on, I don't know, the way that you're working through different modes or degrees of presentness and almost like poetic disassociation. You know, it's like the intense attention to the here and now, feeling sensations in the moment, but then this like voice that is almost disembodied and narrating. Mm-hmm. And for some reason in that moment, that was really highlighted to me. Yeah. Maybe because it's so artificial, like that jump, you know? It's
yeah.
Like, there's something very disembodied about that.
Mm. Yeah, I think it's interesting because I wrote this book from May. It was another kind of like, oh, I guess I'm doing this for a year kind of book project for me. So May of 2023, and I finished it up in May of this year. And just reading this piece right now, I was kind of struck by how much the past comes into it, because I do think of this book and my writing in general as being like very kind of like about being in the present. Mm-hmm. But it really is like how being in the present and being grounded in the present allows, it's kind of like forms the, creates, and I'll say that it fabricates a stability where the past can come in.
Okay. Yeah, I think I see what you're saying. So that it's like almost a kind of attention that clears a space for things that you don't otherwise allow space for.
Yeah. I'm only just having this thought now,
yeah.
Which is, you know, just born of this conversation with you.
Hmm.
I feel kind of like I've been saying this for so many years, but I, you know, it's kind of like some of the poets that I look to, like Philip Whalen, for me, I can't ever not think about his description of writing poetry as like a nerve movie, is one way he described it, I believe, and a picture of the mind moving. And so the mind, as we all know, if you pay attention to the way that our minds work, it is never in a linear fashion, and there's a lot of clips, breaks. So I guess I'm trying to kind of like create a space for all time.
Yeah.
And I can do that best by rooting myself in the workaday.
Yeah.
And I think that's why I write about work so much. Because, you know, it's a fact of life that, or a fact of my life and most people's lives, that we all need to do something that we don't necessarily want to be doing for a lot of hours of the week.
Right. And yeah, just to, again, sort of point to that moment where there's this warp into this other place, and the speaker is going to see the family. And it comes right after this account of the calf being born. And so that makes me think about how these poems are contemplating the idea of lineage in many different ways. And to me, there's something that feels kind of out of reach or lost when it comes to that connection with blood lineage. And so I was wondering to you, are these poems somehow a project of recovering connection?
I would say big time. Yeah. I love that way of saying it. I think maybe before I say anything else, I just realized that these poems are going to make a lot more sense if I say, you know, I actually work on a organic dairy farm it's a nonprofit and I write grants and I'm a fundraiser. So that is the context of this book, the entire book. My partner, as I kind of like prepare the book for publication, and my partner has encouraged me to think about like what I want to say about it. And, you know, she said, you know, it's a book of friendship. And my first thought was like, yes, it's a book of friendship about me and some cows. But as I'm kind of rereading the poem, I'm like, well, there is actually a lot of human friendship and human connection, but it's kind of like maybe again, the friendship with cows allows me to think about maybe some of the more, well, I was going to say more painful or more complicated relationships with humans, but my friendship with cows is also very highly emotional and highly complex. And so it's just different. And they both exist in the book side by side, and like one helps the other and vice versa.
Yeah. I wonder if that kind of connection being wordless is especially meaningful to somebody who works with words. Or, I don't know, this is what I think about when I'm hanging out with my cat. Like all of these things that are transpiring between us without the use of words. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and I think so many people have animals that they live with, and cows are, you know, of course, domesticated, but we don't really live with cows, so... And, you know, I have had dogs in my life, and I kind of, like, understand dog language. But working on this farm, I was like, oh, cow language, I'm not so sure. So it's been a really interesting process of getting to know each cow's personality and, like, what, you know, what means what. And sometimes it's really it changes from week to week.
Yeah, and also like watching them in the context of agriculture, where fertility is so much in the foreground.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I was really struck by that.
Right.
That move from the cow giving birth to then it's like I went away to the family.
Yeah. And I will say that, you know, I rolled up to the dairy farm looking for a job and really not knowing that much about the dairy business and like the role of fertility and how, you know, it's like it's all about cows being pregnant because that's where milk, that's where dairy comes from, is this cycle of cows getting pregnant, having calves. And within that, cows, you know, get sent to slaughter, not as frequently as in a beef herd, but, cows do get sent to slaughter. So it was really shocking to me. And so the central story of my friendship with Donna is like realizing that I had befriended this cow, who ended up being seen as a horrible dairy cow and got shipped, which is the euphemism for sent to slaughter. And like the shock of that and then, you know, kind of just like being in the complexity of what actions I wanted to take, you know, and, you know, it did inspire some action. Like I stopped eating cows. But I kind of, for the most, I still have the job and work at the farm. And just kind of, instead of being judgmental or, you know, being in some kind of heightened state of protest, I've gone the route of kind of being in the complexity of that situation and my, you know, like what, I don't know. It's hard to be articulate about, but basically it's just like, how can I ethically, you know, what are my ethics around this? And like, how do I want to change? And like, I don't know. I can honestly sit here today and say, like, I don't know how this is going to end up, you know?
Yeah.
I'm not sure quite how I feel. And I'm, you know, I think the writing is showing, is kind of reflecting that, you know, my grappling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I kind of want to push more on the question of lineage, because there's also, so there's the way in which these poems reflect on blood lineage and also artistic lineages. And
as well as cow lineage.
Yeah. And I noticed that when the writing moves to reflection upon poetic lineage, it's very, very grateful and affectionate. And yeah, I mean, my sense is that there's a really clear and kind of focused awareness of the sustenance that those lineages provide. And so, you know, you mentioned Philip Whalen, but can you talk a little bit more how different artistic lineages are coinciding in this work?
Yes, I think that, again, going over the poems recently, I was kind of struck by how many of the poets that I reference are from the West Coast, and this book is going to be published by Kripskaya Books, which is based in the Bay Area. There's something about it that feels like very West Coast. It's like, you know, it's very like rooted. Again, there's that kind of like contradiction where it's like it's rooted in the Hudson Valley of New York, but it seems like a very West Coast book, and the people that have responded the most strongly to the work have been in the Bay Area, which I find very interesting. But yeah, there's like Lou Welch is in there. Joanne Kiger, I don't think I refer to, but as a kind of a presence in there through the poetics. I think this is a theme that is very present in my books, and I just feel like it's part of how I understand my purpose, and it's part of how I move in the world, and it's part of like what makes it, you know, I feel like I don't know how to say it in a way that's not like it feels minimizing, but I feel very held by feeling like I am keeping alive a lineage. And not in any kind of like academic way or pretentious way, or, you know, I'm not evangelizing about these poets. I'm not an academic. I'm not teaching them. It's just very personal to me. And like, I feel like I am among them, moving among them. And it's also like not like woo woo or, you know, like I'm not having like seances. Well, I have had one seance, but.
But those connections for you, my sense is that they are very personal in that they're based in real life friendships and interactions for the most part. I mean, I know, like, just thinking about your work at the Poetry Project, it's like they're people who were in your life to varying degrees. So it's not abstract.
Right. So, you know, there is the the element of the past again, that, for instance, like my work at the project was an everyday continuance of my understanding of lineage. Mm-hmm. So starting the mentorship program, trying to foster intergenerational friendship and conviviality at the very least through the readings and the programming. I feel like it is an ethic of just being capacious.
Yeah, and I see that as also an alternative or a mode of cultural transmission that is an alternative to academia. Just those intergenerational friendships. Yeah, so even keeping alive that possibility. I mean, I feel like something that your writing and your work in general is doing is keeping alive that possibility, because the possibility seems to be, it is being replaced by, you know, whatever. I am not interested in talking about, like, alienation in our digital whatever. But for whatever reason, it's like something that needs to be actively, you know, sustained.
And, you know, I just feel like it, giving you a shout out at this moment, because it occurs to me, I'm like, oh, well, you were, I think, in the first cohort of ESB, or one of the first. Kind of see, you know, I've pay attention to what you're doing in the organizing work and this radio show. And I see that in the context of the Poetry Project and that program, not limited to that context, but like it is a context in which I understand like your current organizing for poetry, the name of poetry, and all the presses that you're working for and all the fundraising that you do.
Yeah, so, definitely.
It was very gratifying.
For me, I mean, it was like, it felt like a way of honoring and making more real and long-lasting, intergenerational connections that were already there, but weren't given the time and space to flourish. I think that's what that project or that program meant for me. If you're just tuning in, this is Specific Objects, Talks on Art in the Catskills, and I'm your host, Miriam Atkin. Here in the studio with me today is Catskill-based poet Stacey Simazic. So there's a lot about survival in these poems, just how to get through the daily challenges of being a human. And I guess, speaking broadly, what are some of the conditions related to daily survival that these poems are reflecting on?
Well, there's always a lot about health. And so, you know, becoming middle-aged, menopause.
Yeah.
Experiencing bodily changes that, you know, I haven't really experienced. You know, I feel like I'm not the first person to say it, but it really hit home. Like, oh, this is like going through puberty, or, you know, it's like that level of physical change
mm-hmm.
somewhat rapidly. So that's a big one, you know, being a 55-year-old woman.
Yeah.
I made a lot of kind of later in life changes that I think maybe, I don't know, if I don't know what, you know, what normal is,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I think that's part of, you know, what I explore in this book too, is like, I have a family who, you know, thinks the way I live is pretty strange. And so like the fact that I would like leave the poetry project in 2018 with no job prospects.
Yeah.
Just take a giant leap of faith. I haven't had like a totally, from the outside, it could be like, oh, that's not a very stable life, you know, but like, it's an artist's life. And I think that, you know, inviting a degree of that, I don't know, precarity is too strong a word, but like not, you know, just like being open to what's next. And, you know, like, oh, like I probably am not going to have this job for the rest of my life. And what am I going to do next? And will I ever be able to retire? And, you know, am I going to have enough money? And, you know, so those kinds of concerns. And that, you know, do I have enough energy and will and fortitude to kind of like keep on being a poet when it just seems like it gets harder and harder? I think now socially it's harder to be a poet now than I've ever experienced in my lifetime.
Yeah, I want to ask about that. I also want to ask, I mean, in what you just said, I heard two things. And one is that, well, I heard one thing, and that's that poetry may make survival more difficult. And then the other side of it is that it's a means of survival.
There you go. So if I'm being perfectly clear.
Yeah.
You got it.
So as far as like the difficulties of being a poet go, this word usefulness comes up
mm-hmm.
a number of times in your author's note that introduced the poems in Peripheries. And there you say that the poems ponder the possibility of loving beyond usefulness. And I read this to be about the kind of blurring between friendship and opportunism that can happen in literary scenes or really any art scene.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure if that's what you mean, but I'm interested in hearing how you conceive of that loving beyond usefulness.
Yeah, I think that's a theme early in the essays. I think things midway through turn pretty heavily toward the cows and the herd. But yes, that kind of connection with like the, you know, Donna, the cow being sent to slaughter because she was not useful.
Right.
And I think that's, you know, that there's, I connected with that. And that is what I meant. I think, you know, no, I don't think, I know. That is what I was referring to, is this like feeling of this confusion between what is friendship when one is in a role that has some power and that, you know, I got to make a lot of decisions
mm-hmm.
that were important to people. And so, you know, I think, I mean, I'm not here to like trash
yeah.
everybody I knew while I was directing the Poetry Project for 11 years, or to say that all of those friendships were fake. But I mean, I think that it was remarkable when I left. How much I realized how much that job structured everything in my life, everything.
Hmm.
And so when that structure wasn't there, it was shocking.
Hmm.
And a lot of things changed. And a lot of people just weren't there anymore.
Hmm.
And that, you know, I wasn't there literally. But a lot of things just kind of evaporated.
Yeah, I mean, something about networks of friendship structured by usefulness, that's still present even when there's not a clear, when like you're not in a relationship of power. I think I was just thinking about creative scenes in which, you know, we're creators and critics and readers of each other's work, and sometimes publishers, or, you know, if it's in the visual arts, exhibitors. And for me, growing up in Buffalo, so I have this background of like the smaller city art scene where everyone, it's almost like you make each other viable because you are each other's audience. And that is also a kind of exchange of usefulness. But yeah, it's not negative. I mean, it could be seen that way or experienced that way or spiral into something that is exploitative. But yeah, I mean, I was just grateful that the poems allowed me this meditation on those kinds of friendships.
Yeah.
And I was really interested in the title of the series, which I know, again, from your author's note, it's in conversation with two other poems called Essay, one by Stephanie Young and one by Bernadette Mayer. And both of those poems are about lost time in some sense, or the feeling of having missed the chance to do something. Mm-hmm. I guess I was wondering if you could speak on that a little bit, or just talk about the word essay as a title. What is your relationship to that, or what is your relationship to the essay as form?
I think that I really like essays. Well, I mean, I like the word essay used as like an exploration. What I think the definition is to attempt.
Mm-hmm.
So that, on top of, you know, having this kind of aha moment with Bernadette's poem and then discovering that Stephanie had done an essay based on Bernadette's poem. So, you know, working on a farm and reading Bernadette's line, I guess it's too late to start farming. You know, and it kind of, it's very incantatory. I guess it's too late to live on a farm. I mean, these aren't direct quotes. I'm just riffing from memory. And it's just like, oh, I guess we'll never be farmers. And I was like, oh, you know, it really kind of struck a chord with me, because I'm working on a farm, not in a farming context,
mm-hmm.
but kind of I met somebody recently who was like, oh, you're a farm whore. Can I say that?
Yeah, I think so.
That's not one of the words.
I don't think so.
Or a farm slut? Can I say slut?
I think so. I think both of them are.
I'm sure. I'm both a whore and a slut. It's kind of a weird role to occupy. It's totally made me lose my train of thought.
About the word essay and the two other essay poems.
Yes. And then, yeah, so I think those two poems, and then at the same time I had picked up John Cage's diary, How to Change the World. I can't remember. How to Change the World, and then there's like, you'll only make it worse, or something like that. And, you know, his formal, it's very, very kind of written in the center of the page. Lot, you know, just his kind of like crazy, it's color coded. I was very, very influenced by that kind of form.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm interested in essays, and I want to say things. You know, I like ideas, and I like that kind of like, you know, but I'm not, I don't feel like I have in an essay, I feel like, you know, it's like, I don't have anything that I feel like I can definitively say, you know, so it's like, I'm kind of like playing with this idea that like, I have an essay, I'm going to write an essay because I have something important to say. And I mean, I have important things to say as a poet. I know I'm not being totally clear here, but I guess I wanted an experimental. I was like, what if I wrote an experimental essay? So there, you know, for those listening, there's only a very spare amount of periods in these poems. There's not a lot of punctuation. And they are very rangy, kind of swerving in a zigzag across the page. I'm just not very interested in writing a standard sentence, mm-hmm. but I love the poetic line.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the breath. So I composed through visual
mm-hmm.
cues as well as the line is kind of like a building block.
Hmm.
And I think poetry is like a really good form for this kind of, I don't know if you call it discursive, but just very kind of associative, obsessed with time. You know, these are the things that are continually important, have been important to me. So I'm just interested in new forms. That's one of the things I love about poetry is I don't ever have to write in the same form.
Yeah.
So I wanted to escape sentences and paragraphs.
Yeah, the fact that you're thinking about them is present in these poems too, because you really feel like the way that the lines are enjambed, and so you have the kind of pacing or the mm-hmm. suggestion of a new sentence beginning,
mm-hmm.
but no indicator that something has ended and something mm-hmm. has begun. Mm-hmm. Sometimes there will be an end stopped line with a period at the end, but it's kind of, it's like just a couple per page or something like that. And yeah, it just, for me as a reader, it put me in a space of reflecting on the sentence, like what it does to my understanding or my comprehension of what's mm-hmm. being read or told to me, but also the form of these poems creates this kind of experience where the individual words aren't subordinated to larger units of meaning, like, you know, the sentence, because right. the way it proceeds, you really have to, each word has a gravity to it.
Right. Yeah. And that is extremely important to me. And it, you know, that needs to be an element in my writing. And so it's like, how do I kind of extend my line and maintain that sense that every word has been chosen for a reason and is an acting in community.
Yeah, like rather than the words are just vehicles to get to to reach an objective.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I'm thinking about usefulness again, and like the essay as the useful mm-hmm. genre and the poem as the
right.
genre that about which students always say, what's the point of this?
Right.
You know?
Right. So it's like, I guess what I'm saying is poetry is both useless and useful.
I mean, I think that I could definitely, if I were to just shift my focus and say, I'm looking at this as an essay, I could pull out arguments
mm-hmm.
and evidence
mm-hmm.
and all of that. So it's an essay.
There you go. Aptly titled. But yeah, I do think, you know, just to echo something that you said, I think that one of the other things I love about poetry is kind of that sense of like conducting. It's almost like, you know, like a conductor. It's like, I'm going to break the line here on this word, and it's going to make, it could potentially create a reaction.
Mm-hmm.
Because obviously I want it to be emotional.
Yeah.
I want to create, not in any kind of false way, but if, you know, I want to, there's ways to, you know, there's things you can do in language and stylistically that like create a heightened sense of awareness, and a heightened emotion where, you know, where you want it.
Is that musical to some degree? And I'm asking that just thinking about the reference to Sinead O'Connor in the poem and other musical influences that right. come in.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of essays in essay. I mean, you could just pull out all of the folk singers that I write about. You could pull out all the cow material, and that's another essay, and then, like, all of the things about my past.
Yeah.
My home, like, you know, it's like, so there's just, like, it's kind of, like, all spliced in there. But, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, we both do a lot of driving.
Yeah.
And so the playlist has become a part of my life and making playlists. Mm-hmm. And I think part of the impetus for this book was actually making a playlist that I would write to. And so particularly in the first half of the book, there's a lot of writing about Karen Dalton and Connie Converse
mm-hmm.
and these kind of women who... maybe there's a bit of a renaissance now about them or around them. But, you know, they were people who made music and had a really hard time with the business
mm-hmm.
and, you know, died not really knowing success and mm-hmm. not having a lot of money. So Karen Dalton died of AIDS-related complications, and Connie Converse disappeared. You know, assumed suicide. And Sinead O'Connor, and there, you know, there's a number of mostly women, but there's some men in there too that I talk about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you say in that author's note that you are on a hunt for a sound, and I really liked that line. Mm.
Thank you.
And I feel like the sound
of lesbians. I'm like, oh my God. It's like, oh wait, I should look into this person. I'm like, oh, this person's a lesbian. Oh, she was a lesbian. It's a real knack. My gift.
We've somehow mostly used up our time.
No way.
Yes.
Wow. That went fast.
So I want to ask you to read again so that we can end with the sound of your poetry.
Great idea. Okay, I'm going to end with essay 14. And there's 25 in the book, I think. 25, yeah. Essay 14. The poet, Sachio Ito, was a dairy farmer. Wrote lines about brushing the cows daily and how his clothes must stink. It is such a smell. It is such a beautiful smell that there is no one word for. So I will say it is the smell of time, the hot, fermented core of living matter, the inner hay that can look like seaweed. That is the basis of my winter routine. Meeting Wren in the back part of the dry cow paddock to feed her this prized hay. She is never willing to share, using her huge horns to clear space around her, so the others can only watch as she gets the best bits. Cairo, being among the others. I've worked out a way to feed them both by giving Wren a mouthful and then rushing to the other side to feed Cairo. Today, Ren took an apple and let me scratch her head, but she likes it best when we are close but not touching. I learned that she is part Brangus Brahmin mixed with Angus, and something else I forgot. The closer I feel to some cows, the harder it gets to narrate, is best conveyed by the harmony running through my playlist, or low excitement that we call a habit, or somehow coalescing in thin air, innocence and horror of being. We sang to the cows during Saturnalia. The cattle are lowing, the baby awakes. The belief holds that on Christmas Eve, animals gang the gift of speech at midnight. But what if humans gained the gift of going on olfactory cues, reading degrees of muscle tension, nonverbal auditory sounds such as lowing and waking? Ito wrote, "When cowherds begin to make poems, many new styles in the world will spring up. When cowherders begin to make poems, we will gain the gift of mooing." The oldest surviving English poem was written by a herder in the 600s named Cædmon, who is said to have been illiterate, but after a dream visitation was able to sing words that he had never heard of before. The oldest known poem is, of course, Gilgamesh, whose mother's name, Ninsun, means wild cow. She helped her son interpret his dreams. In the story of Ferdinand, the bull grew up to become entirely himself. The real-life gentle civilon, large civilian, a colloquial slur Spanish soldiers used for ordinary citizens, was granted a rare pardon after a bullfight. But before he could make it back to his pasture and the farmer's daughter who loved him, Franco's militiamen butchered him and ate him before the resistance could drive them away. In December, a young longhorn steer, they say escaped a slaughterhouse in Newark, ended up on New Jersey transit tracks, causing long delays. He was rescued by Sanctuary and is recovering from an infection. They named him Ricardo, after a helpful police officer. I just watched a video of him eating apples with his IV and balls of tape on the tips of his horns. He is sweet and calm with a chestnut coat. As always, with feel-good local news, one can always sense the hand of management. The bull at the farm I work at is named Luke. His mating bellow interrupts our meetings and keeps the apprentices living next to the shed up at night. During lunch last week, my colleague and I witnessed Luke mate with a cow. An apprentice came up and asked, "Was he successful?" "If it takes 4 seconds, I think so." The pair gently clacked their horns. He continued to follow her, inhaling her estrus, his lips curled and nostrils partly closed. I learned that this is called the Fleming response. In the chaos of mating, I still kept up the effort to comb Donut, whose long winter coat has been patchy due to a winter's lack of vitamin D. The hierarchy kicked into high formal, the rhythmic body sweep of the feeding stalls such that Donut and I had to re-find each other every few minutes.
To close this show, I just wanted to ask about what you have coming up. Any readings or publications that you want to mention?
No readings at the moment, but the book essay will be published by Krupskaya Books in 2025 at some point.
Great. And where can we learn more about your work?
I have a website at stacysamazic.org.
Well, Stacy, it was a pleasure to talk with you, and thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you so much for your thoughtful questions.
Thank you.